The trial of the former Minneapolis police officer and last year's death of George Floyd is winding down. After 3 weeks of testimony and expert opinions, the prosecution and defense made their closing arguments today. Now the fate of former officer Derek Chauvin is in the hands of the jury. He's charged with second and third degree murder and second degree manslaughter. The incident sparked protests and violence in Minneapolis and other cities across the country last summer. Tensions in the Twin Cities have been heightened, not just because of the Chauvin case, but last week's shooting death of a black man by police in the nearby suburb of Brooklyn Center. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions about the latest and where things stand in the Derek Chauvin trial? Have you been following it yourself? What do you feel about the arguments from the prosecution and defense? Is there an outcome you're hoping for? How would you describe your general feelings toward police if you're an officer or a retired officer? What's going through your mind? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Mark Osler is the Robert and Marion Short Professor of Law at the University of St. Thomas in Minneapolis. Mark, welcome back to the show.
Thanks. Good to be here.
Before we visit the trial, Mark, can you give us a sense of what things are like in the Twin Cities right now as the jury meets, as people are watching for this verdict in the future?
Yeah, it is a very different atmosphere, quite tense. That yesterday I was in the uptown neighborhood and there was one corner where on each, each corner there was an armored personnel carrier and National Guardsmen standing in front of stores. And of course, that's unusual at any time. So it's definitely ratcheted up the anxiety in this area.
What were some of the key moments in the Chauvin trial so far as you've been following it?
Well, we're pretty much done. We just finished up the closing arguments. But, you know, looking at the most important witnesses, in closing, the government relied a lot on Charles McMillan, a man who came and testified, said he witnessed the killing, that he had an exchange with Officer Chauvin. They also talked a lot about a 9-year-old girl who wasn't named during the trial for privacy reasons, for the conclusion that even a 9-year-old knew that this was wrong as she watched it happening. And so in retrospect, looking at what the government relied in their closing, those two were both very important, as was, of course, the expert testimony of Dr. Martin Tobin, who was, by many accounts, one of the best expert witnesses many of us have ever seen. He was credible. He was consistent. He seemed very authoritative. And so that was crucial. And then the defense did not call many witnesses, and they only had two experts, and their medical expert did not seem to be a match for Dr. Tobin. So we got to closings, and today what surprised a lot of people was the length of the closings. Typically, these will be an hour, at most an hour and a half. The government went for an hour and 45 minutes, and the defense, I believe, went almost 3 hours in their closing. So they took up a lot more time. Something very unusual happened today, which is that the judge interrupted the closing argument of the defense because it was 2:10 and the jury hadn't had lunch yet. And so he let them go, get their lunch, and then returned to the closing after that.
We're looking at the Derek Chauvin trial in Minneapolis with Mark Osler from the University of St. Thomas in Minneapolis, law professor there. You can join in with your questions and thoughts at 800-642-1234. I want to give a listen to a little bit of each of the closing arguments. First of all, prosecutors described Chauvin as a killer who knew what he was doing to George Floyd. Here's attorney Steve Schleicher talking to the jury.
And what the defendant did here was a straight up felony assault. This was not policing. It was unnecessary. It was gratuitous. It was disproportionate. And he did it on purpose. No question. This was not an accident. He did not trip and fall and find himself upon George Floyd's knee and neck. He did what he did on purpose. And it killed George Floyd.
A couple of things there, Mark. First of all, saying this was a deliberate act. Also that phrase, this was not policing. And the prosecution seemed to be careful today to say police are not on trial here today. Derek Chauvin is. Can you talk about those aspects of the closing?
Yeah, and just on the second one first about policing, that's something that they emphasized throughout the trial. One of the unusual aspects of this trial was that we saw the blue wall of silence come down, that there were a number of police officers who testified against their fellow officer here. And certainly they were treated with great respect by both sides. And, you know, on intent, that's something that is an element of it's a little tricky because the felony murder, the intent has to be to commit an assault. So that argument that this wasn't accidental, this is something that he did and it went beyond policing. It wasn't something that was a legitimate use of force, but something that went beyond what would be a legitimate use of force was an argument they really had to make to counter the defense.
Now, here is Chauvin's attorney on the defense side, Eric Nelson, telling jurors that they didn't get a complete picture of events from the prosecution. Here's a listen.
Throughout the course of this trial, you've seen us do this, right? Little snippets. A second here, a second there, a screenshot here, a screenshot there. You need to review the entirety of the evidence in this case during the course of your deliberations as well. And I can tell you that some of the videos that we've seen, they're much longer than what was presented in court. There's additional information, and you're going to see some of that as we go through this case today.
So, Mark, what do you make of that effort to telling the jury, hey, look at the whole context, the whole story here from the defense?
It was something that worked pretty well for Mr. Nelson, that what he wanted to do was use that video to establish more context, that the government had really focused on the 9 minutes and 29 seconds in which ex-officer Chauvin had his knee on the neck of George Floyd. And the defense was trying to broaden the lens so that the context of what happened before that was before the jury as well. And some of the things that he did were interesting. For example, something that was raised by one of the witnesses was that while he had his knee on the neck, Officer Chauvin, he lifted his foot off the ground, which seemed that he was shifting all of his weight on top of the neck. And of course, that was presented as a still photograph. And what Eric Nelson did was go back and show that entire video clip to emphasize the brief moment of time in which the foot was actually off the ground. And so he was able to make some points there. And it was interesting because it was the inverse of what many of us expected, which is that video was going to be used mostly by the government. It turned out that probably the defense used video more in their closing than the government did.
You had tweeted earlier today, Mark, that as important as the closing arguments were, you saw something important in the judge's instructions to the jury for their deliberations when it came to the theories as to the cause of George Floyd's death. Can you talk about what the judge said to the jurors?
Yeah, what the judge said on causation. I mean, there's a couple of things that were really important there. And the most important one, and this is something that came up because I think this was being misconstrued or misrepresented by Eric Nelson in closing, is that the Derek Chauvin doesn't have to have been the only cause, that there could be other causes. It's just his actions only need to be a substantial cause. And a lot of the argument that we heard from the defense was that, they said there weren't any other causes. Not really what they were presenting, and certainly not what the legal standard is. What I was tweeting about before is that when the judge was instructing them superseding causes, he said that if you're going to find a superseding cause actually was the cause of the death, that has to have only been the only cause, and standing on its own as a but-for cause of the death.
We're picking up our conversation about the Derek Chauvin trial, the former police officer in Minneapolis charged in the death of George Floyd last year. Closing arguments began this morning, wrapped up this afternoon. Now the jury will decide whether Chauvin's innocent or guilty of the murder and manslaughter charges against him. Mark Osler stays with us, law professor at the University of St. Thomas in Minneapolis, and you could join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 with your thoughts on what you've seen, if you've been following this trial, your questions for our guest. That's 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Brad is with us in West Bend. Brad, hi.
Hi, how you doing today?
Good. What did you want to bring up, Brad?
Well, I guess my comment is this. After all the testimonies of the superiors who said none of this was trained, none of this, every single action he took was incorrect, to think that a jury of people, I get it, that it's a system, to think that, you know, someone who may be a baker, someone who may be a retail worker, someone might be able to take everything that was told to them, like, no, he was wrong, we're the superiors, but no, I'm still going to let him go, I'm still going to vote not guilty, even though I have no expertise, I have none of that, because I'm a retail worker and such and such. I guess to me, when all your superiors come in and say, no, you were wrong, it shouldn't be much of a trial, per se. It should just be, how much time are you looking at?
Brad, thanks a lot for the call. And that's the nature of jury trials, Mark. I guess we bring in everyday folks to evaluate these claims made by people, whether it's, as Brad is talking about, the police supervisors or the medical experts evaluating those claims and trying to figure out what to do with them.
Yeah, and you know, one thing that we need to realize is how unusual we are in relying on jury trials. I've been talking today to Al Jazeera, to a radio station in New Zealand, and one of the questions that I hear often from them is, why have a jury decide this? Why not have experts decide it? And we have good reasons for juries, that it does bring an understanding of the community to bear that's really important. Also, having 12 people compare notes means that someone caught everything, probably one way or another, and it's done us well over time.
Thanks a lot for that call, Brad. But in this particular case, Mark, with, as Brad mentioned, those police supervisors, Chauvin's own superior officers testifying against them, how much weight, and again, I will not ask you to predict what a jury will do, but how much weight do you think testimony like that could carry?
I think it does matter. And, you know, that blue wall of silence that where police protect one another really came down in this case. And I was hearing from the pool reporter who was in the room at the time that, especially when Chief Arredondo was testifying, that the jurors were really plugged into that it did matter that you had these police officers saying this was wrong.
Thanks a lot for that call, Brad, at 800-642-1234. We'll go now to Laura with us in Manitowoc. Laura, hi.
Hi. I'm glad that you have a law professor on, because I would like for him to address this little bit of logic, or rather illogic, which is that we're referring to Officer Chauvin as former Officer Chauvin. And I don't know if that is a result of, you know, if that's a temporary thing, or I can't imagine that no matter what the outcome of this case is, that anyone expects that he's going to work again as a police officer. So in light of that, if the defense is making the argument, or if either side is making the argument, that his behavior was within the line of duty of a police officer, that it was police officer conduct, it's almost like it's colored already. Like, we're saying that what he did is certainly not police officer conduct, because he's been removed from his job. He's lost his title. He'll never work again. Isn't that sort of an indictment or a verdict right there?
Laura, thanks for the call. And correct me if I'm wrong, Mark. I believe Chauvin was fired, in effect, a day or so after Memorial Day last year.
It was the day after the incident. It was Chief Arredondo who did that, and did it in a very public way, fired all four of them and said that this is not behavior that we're going to tolerate in our department. He was quite firm and quick in doing that.
And is this, thanks for the call, Laura, is this something, as Laura was saying there, that shows up in the trial, that maybe even the prosecution brought up, that the fact that he was fired here suggests that the defense is wrong in arguing that he was working within the bounds of an on-duty officer?
Actually, I don't think that came into the evidence. I seem to remember that was a subject of a motion in limine, that they didn't want that coming in about him being fired and exactly when. You know, typically that kind of administrative measure won't come into the criminal trial. And at any rate, you know, whatever it is that caused the chief to make that decision, that information was before the jury as well, and they can make their independent evaluation.
Thanks a lot for that call, Laura, at 800-642-1234. Talking to Mark Osler, professor of law at the University of St. Thomas in Minneapolis, looking at the trial of former Minneapolis police officer Derek Chauvin. Back to our callers now. Cindy is with us in Appleton. Cindy, hi.
Hello. Well, my fear is that he's going to be acquitted and not found guilty of murder. And I just think that would be a really sad thing if this has happened too many times, because all this does is give the police more power to continue to murder our citizens. And if we would convict a few of these officers, send them to prison, I would think from there on out, people would think twice before they murder one of our citizens. This has got to stop.
Cindy, thanks a lot for the call. And Mark, I think a lot of people, wherever they stand on hoping for an outcome of the trial, share with Cindy the idea that the trial could and maybe should send a message about policing to the wider public. In a courtroom, though, is that something people are talking about, or is that something they're really trying to steer clear of?
Well, you know, it's in some states, it's allowable for the government, in making their closing argument, to say to the jurors, you should send a message to the community that we will not tolerate that. And, you know, other states don't allow that send a message language. But it certainly is, it's a role of criminal law that we're drawing the lines. And I certainly agree with the caller that I think there should be a conviction here based on what I've seen. And I expect that there will be. And that will be, hopefully, an inflection point in our society where there's a new era of holding the police accountable when things like this happen.
Thanks a lot for that call, Cindy. I imagine if I were a defense attorney in a case like this, though, Mark, I would try to be convincing the jury that you are not trying, you're not trying on the basis of sending a message. You are supposed to be looking at the details of this particular case. Is that something we heard from the defense here?
Yeah, I think that Eric Nelson did try to, you know, keep their eye down on the ball and show reasonable doubt, and that it was about, you know, the facts that were before them. But we didn't hear the government really making that send a message argument. So it didn't come in, and that's probably appropriate.
Let's go now to Paul with us in Eau Claire. Paul, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What did you want to bring up, Paul?
Good. My comment is that I think it's going to be very hard to get 12 jurors to unanimously agree on anything, let alone that this police officer intentionally tried to kill this man. I think if this was a civil case, that's one thing. But as we all know, O.J. Simpson got off. And I just think it's going to be very hard to convince 12 jurors to agree all to the same thing.
Paul, thanks a lot for the call. And especially, Mark, with the standard that the defense attorney was raising of beyond reasonable doubt here, do you see that Paul might be right, that it might be a challenge to get the jurors to agree on something?
Absolutely. It often is a challenge, and it only takes one juror to create a hung jury situation. But there's two things in play here that do mean that we could end up with a conviction, very likely we'll end up with a conviction. One is time, that they have all the time in the world to work on that holdout juror, at least until the judge calls a halt to it. And the other is the ability to compromise, that there's three counts here. And if there's someone who's for acquittal and the overwhelming majority of the jury is for second-degree murder, it's entirely possible that they'll compromise on third-degree murder or second-degree manslaughter, and that's the outcome that we'd see, so that they could get it done and go home from the perspective of some of those jurors.
Thanks for the call. Time for one more caller. We'll go to Holly with us in Sheboygan. Holly, hi.
Hi. I guess I'm on the fence about this situation. I understand and do believe that the police officer used the wrong procedures and did cause the death of George Floyd. But I see in many of these cases that are happening all over the United States, there's so much resisting arrest, and it puts officers in a bind trying to hold a person down. And so they use the excuse of, I can't breathe, or this is something, or whatever, and the officer lets up, and then they take off on him, or just the officer gets hurt.
Holly, thanks a lot for the call. We just have a minute or so left. Mark, was that part of the defense argument that you know, the police face this uncertainty if someone might at some point be resisting arrest?
Yeah, and that the threat that might pose. Look, in the end, let's imagine that they just let him go. They had his ID. They knew who he was. They would have been able to come back to him about the $20 counterfeit. That the problem is that if people resist arrest or do resist, the response can't be to kill them.
Holly, thanks for the call. Mark, what do we know about a timeline? You said the jurors have, in some ways, as much time as they want. What are people expecting for deliberations at a timeline?
Well, most people I'm talking about expect it to be short or long. In other words, we'll get a verdict back by tomorrow, which would be short. Or if there's a holdout or a few holdouts, that will take a much longer period of time. We could be looking at a week.
Mark, we'll leave it there. Thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure.
Mark Osler is a professor of law at the University of St. Thomas in Minneapolis. We talked to him today about the trial of former Minneapolis police officer Derek Chauvin. Closing arguments wrapped up this afternoon. Now the case is in the hands of the jury. As we heard, a verdict could come quickly or it could take a while.